I'm Keith Parent, and welcome to Focus Asia Pacific. Coming up today, we have a special on some of the activities that took place last week in Bali, Indonesia, for the 10th anniversary of the Bali bombings. Foxconn admits employing underage interns in China, and most Asian pension schemes inadequate. We have this on this week's edition of Focus Asia Pacific, putting the focus on the Asia Pacific. On October 12, 2002, the deadliest terror attack in Indonesian history took place in the Kuta district on Bali Island. 202 people died and more than 250 people were injured in an attack carried out by Jamiah Islamiyah. 88 Australians were killed, along with 32 Indonesians, 24 Britons, as well as citizens from the US and Europe. Last week, memorial services were held in Australia and Indonesia and other places to commemorate those who died. In Canberra, Australia's Governor General Quinton Bryce and Indonesian Charge d'Affaires at the embassy, Wiwat Shawati, addressed the national service.
As the warmth of morning sun announces a new day in Bali, we come together. As waves wash ashore at Kuta, cleansing yesterday's footprints from the sand, we comfort each other. As starlings swoop above the cliffs of the commemorative site at GWK, we gather as one. People from across Australia join in solidarity and support, in love and friendship to remember. Fathers, mothers, husbands, wives, brothers, sisters, sons and daughters, grandparents, cousins, colleagues, lovers, mates. The unbearable pain and grief that pierced our hearts 10 years ago. We remember futures cut short, potential snatched away in a heartbeat, lives left shattered. That fateful night, the unspeakable horror of terrorism came to our backyard as 88 Australians went about enjoying a peaceful holiday, as they have done on thousands of nights, footy teams, families, cobbers. An act of barbarism changed everything. 202 precious lives lost, hundreds injured, all of us left changed forever.
Years ago, the people of Bali went to work and pray, as usual, still struggling through the multi-dimensional crisis that swept Indonesia a few years earlier in 1998. The working Balinese greet the island's visitors with a caring smile. The praying Balinese went about their religious rituals, praying to the gods exactly the way they have done for centuries. But unfortunately, the gods had other plans that night. Indonesia, often called the land of a thousand smiles, that particular evening turned into the land of a million sorrows. The act of a few extremists had taken the lives of peace-loving Balinese and innocent expatriates, most of them from our largest and closest neighbors, Australia. All Indonesians felt anger as to why this happened. And why this happened in Bali. Most of all, 220 million Indonesians felt deep sympathy for all the life lost, the Australian life lost, and for those families and friends left behind. In a land where hospitality is a revered practice and guests are treated like royalty, the Balinese quickly turned to helping those injured and bringing them to care. In times of crisis, as neighbors and friends, we can console and comfort each other.
10 years ago, visitors from around the world were enjoying a night out at the Sari Club in Bali's Ketu district, along with the Indonesian nationals. The presence of foreigners made the club a target for Islamist terrorists who set off explosions so powerful they tore apart the venues and left deep craters in the ground. Australian Prime Minister Julia Gillard attended the special memorial in Bali, where she addressed those attending. Also in attendance was the former Prime Minister John Howard.
We gather here, we gather together, to commemorate the worst terrorist attack our nation has ever known. 88 Australians died here, and they did not die alone. 38 Indonesians died with them. In all, 202 lives were lost, and more than 200 were injured. The bodies of the dead and the living bore wounds more often seen in wartime, but these were not soldiers. Our fellow Australians, those lost, those hurt, were doing nothing more than seeking a few carefree days amid full and busy lives. They had come to a place loved for its sunshine and its uncomplicated joy. A place like London and Gallipoli, where something of the Australian spirit dwells upon another shore. This is what the Bali bombers struck at. On September 11, terrorists attacked the great symbols of American prestige. Here in Bali, they attacked our people and through them sought to overwhelm our values. Here on these bustling streets, they inflicted searing pain and grief that will never end. But even as the debris fell, it was obvious the attack on our sense of ourselves as Australians, as human beings, had failed. Rescuers ran towards the terror. Volunteers extended their hands by the hundred, Indonesians and Australians alike. A remarkable medical effort swung into place. A thorough policing effort followed, methodically dismantling the terrorist network responsible. And our two countries drew closer than we had ever been before. Amid the horror, it was time for heroes, like Peter Hughes and Jason McCartney, victims who became rescuers. Like the Sangla hospital staff who provided frontline care in those critical hours. Or Len Natouris, Fiona Wood and their colleagues who were angels of healing back at home. It was a time for leaders too. President Megawati and Minister Udiono were quick to embrace international cooperation and a decisive security response. Prime Minister Howard was a steadfast, reassuring voice for Australians in those dramatic days, and I am delighted he accepted my invitation to be here today. It is so very fitting. Police Inspector General Pastika and Commissioner Keelty gave us confidence that justice would be done. 10 years later, and we witness today another sort of courage. The courage it has taken for survivors and families to make this pilgrimage. The physical journey by plane has been easy, but the inner journey is wrenchingly hard. This is a day of contesting emotions, from anger and unamended loss to forgiveness and reconciliation with a bitter past. Wounds and scars abound, healed and unhealed. But nothing can replace the empty seat at your family table, the graduations and the christenings you will never know, and the fault line that will always divide your lives into two halves, before Bali and after Bali. There are at least some fragments of comfort on this day of recollection and return. There is peace in this island, and the knowledge that millions still come here for the same reasons you and your loved ones did. And perhaps there is a grim reassurance in knowing that the terrorists did not achieve what they set out to do. They did not undermine Indonesian democracy, which has only grown stronger across the passage of a decade. And though our vigilance is greater, we have not surrendered the freedoms that brought us here in the first place. We were hurt, and so were our friends, but we did not falter. Indeed, we endured and found strength in each other. With that strength, we embrace those who suffered in Bali and lost so much. With that strength, we affirm the endurance of our ideals. Because in the end, terror is not beaten by policing or force of arms alone. We prevail because we have a better way. We prevail because our beliefs endure. Terrorists have killed and maimed thousands around the world, but they will never sunder or displace a single ideal. So today we return here in remembrance, but we also gather in quiet defiance. We will never forget all that we lost. We will hold fast to that which remains, to our determination as a free people to explore the world unbowed by fear, to our resolve to defeat terrorism, and to our duty to care for each other.
Australian Prime Minister Julia Gillard. The Prime Minister at the time of the bombings was John Howard. This is what he had to say at the special memorial in Bali.
To express our gratitude to the police and intelligence services of Australia and Indonesia and many other countries that tracked down and brought to justice those who had murdered your loved ones and left so many of you wounded and badly burnt. I salute, as an Australian who drew enormous pride at the time from the cooperative effort of all our agencies, I salute the Australian spirit that came through at the time. But I also salute the determination of people from different countries and different faiths to unite in the fight against terrorism. If there can be a legacy other than the sadness associated with these events, if there can be a legacy, it is the belief and the knowledge that as the years have gone by, the cooperation between our intelligence services has reduced, but of course never eliminated, the threat of terrorism. And it is proper, as the Prime Minister has said and the Governor has said and the Foreign Minister has said at a time like this, to unite in our determination to oppose terrorism. Those who did these evil things would have hoped to have divided Indonesia and Australia. They would have liked to have divided Islam and Christianity and Judaism and Buddhism and other religions. But they failed in that as well, because out of this terrible deed came the interfaith dialogue, which allowed regional religious leaders to focus on what our religions have in common. And one thing they have in common is an abhorrence of violence, an abhorrence of murder, and a desire for peace and cooperation. Can I just finally say to all of those who have come here today with very heavy hearts and with a sad recollection of the loss of loved ones and a change in their lives that can never be turned back, the compassion felt by your fellow Australians all those years ago remains in a different form, but you are not forgotten, your loss is not forgotten, and the great memorial of those who you lost is to be found in the determination of the young of Australia to keep coming to Bali, to keep enjoying the hospitality of the Balinese people, and to retain and build further the friendship between the people of Australia and the people of Indonesia. Thank you.
Former Prime Minister John Howard, who was Prime Minister at the time of the Bali bombings. Radio Australia's Lehman Cochrane spoke to journalist Lavan Selai, who spoke to some Indonesian survivors of the 2002 bombings.
Actually, I spoke with two victims and one widow of Bali bombings. One important thing is that they claim to have forgiven or apologized all the bombers. Both are the actors who had been executed and the actors who are only involved in the Bali bombings. They are still alive, like Umar Patek, an Indonesian victim, trying to make peace with this situation. And although some of the victims are still suffering because of their physical disabilities.
And what are the victims doing to mark the 10-year anniversary of the bombing?
Many victims and families of the Bali bombing visit the blast site right in front of the Sari Club and Paddy's Cafe. Some of them have lit the candles, placed the photo and put the flowers out there. Especially the victim and the family from Australia. As I know, the victim and families in Indonesian citizen, will pray together tonight at Ground Zero and right in front of the former of Sari Club also.
Is the anniversary getting a lot of attention, media attention and public interest in Indonesia?
Yes, of course, Liam. Almost all media in Indonesia cover the event. This event is certainly important also for the Indonesian citizen, I think. As we know, there are 38 victims died from Indonesia, and I think it is not a small number for a victim of because of terror. To Indonesian minister, we also attend the commemoration of the Bali bombings this morning at Garuda Wisnu Kencana.
And you're listening to Focus Asia Pacific. The electronics giant Foxconn has admitted it used underage technical school students as young as 14 years old as workers in its China operations. Foxconn, which produces iPhones and iPads for Apple as well as other electronic parts, has in the past been accused of poor labor practices and working conditions. Foxconn has issued an apology for violating China's labor laws and says it's investigating. We have this report from Kandahar Sepati.
Foxconn, Apple's main supplier in China, has admitted to employing interns as young as 14 years of age at its Yantai factory in Shandong province in China's northeast. The Yantai factory does not produce Apple products, but with Apple demanding Foxconn maintains basic labor standards, the company felt obliged to admit to its violation, says John Grutzner, the vice president of investment advisory firm Intercedent China.
I think it's openly admitted it because it's in the media, and it's probably its normal public relations crisis management technique to admit something's happened.
Employing students from vocational schools as interns is a normal practice right across the country, and it's believed there are at least 10 million interns at any one time. It's a practice that can work to the benefit of both the students and the factories. Jeffrey Crothall is the communications director of the China Labour Bulletin.
The young people who go to these vocational schools, technical colleges, most of whom are 16 and above, actually. It's not very many who are 14, 15, and 16 is the legal working age in China. But the point is that they go to these vocational schools looking for training to learn a trade, but very often the only jobs available to them, either as an internship or when they graduate, is working in a factory. And the factories, because of their high demands for production of particular products at a particular time, they always want a very cheap and flexible source of labour to meet those production targets.
Unlike in developed countries where an intern is there to observe and learn the ropes, in China, interns are used as workers. According to the Voice of China, at the Yantai factory, which produces Japanese video game consoles, the students are made to work overtime and around the clock. Jeffrey Grothel says these students have no rights.
They're not technically workers. They're not covered by the labour law. They don't have an employment contract with the factory that they're working at. They are technically students, but they're working in a factory. So they're actually in a very dodgy grey area. Are they workers? Are they students?
Foxconn is the largest single provider of foreign investment in Shandong province, where Yantai is located. And it currently needs an additional 20,000 workers to run its factories. And according to reports, the city government of Yantai is requiring schools to send interns to Foxconn, with the largest schools sending in as many as 3,000 students. Jeffrey Grothel again.
Foxconn is particularly influential in this situation because it's such a large company and it has such big business, and local governments fall over themselves to invite Foxconn to set up factories in their jurisdiction. So they will go out of their way to, if necessary, put pressure on local vocational schools to provide the labour that Foxconn needs.
Foxconn has had some bad publicity in recent times over its working conditions for employees. In 2010, 13 employees committed suicide at Foxconn or related plants over appalling work and living conditions. This forced Apple to put pressure on Foxconn to improve its working conditions. Louis Koo is Foxconn's company executive.
What we are facing is changing in a much rapid pace than we could have anticipated in the past. So we are also changing.
But that change has fallen short once again, with Foxconn acknowledging that it has taken in underage interns. The company says the violation occurred because Foxconn employees failed to check the ages of incoming interns, a justification that John Grutzner finds hard to believe.
Again, it's Foxconn's management's decision, but it would be prudent practice to check the identification of anybody who entered into your facilities.
And that report came to us from Kandahar Sapati. With an aging population, declining family support, and longer life expectancy, many Asian countries are struggling to adequately provide for people in retirement. A new report shows there is a need to boost pensions for the poorest of the elderly and improve the regulations. It compares 18 countries and found that Denmark ranks the best, with Australia at number 3. And surprisingly, China is doing a much better job than Japan. Karen Snowden has more.
It's a small difference, but China's pension scheme has the edge over Japan, South Korea and India. They were ranked, along with Australia, Singapore and 13 others, in terms of the adequacy, sustainability and integrity of their public and private pension schemes. Dr. David Knox, senior partner at global consulting firm Mercer and author of the report, says in most cases pensions for the poor need to be increased, even in Singapore, where a public scheme has operated for many years.
Singapore has very modest benefits for the poorest, and again, picking up the Asian culture, has a requirement for you to look after your parents, and therefore the culture is quite different from the West. Our view is that there should be a modest benefit provided to all the poor, and that would be consistent with the World Bank multi-pillar approach, where there is a public pension provided for everybody who is in need.
Many pension schemes aren't delivering the benefits retirees will need. Most in Asia are still new, and the societies still rely on family support and personal savings. At a national conference about the world's largest pension system last week, Chinese Premier Wen Jiabao urged more government spending on pensions, even if it meant cutting investment on other projects, adding it was important for social stability. David Knox says there's a growing recognition a robust pension scheme is necessary.
We've seen a number of reforms in China, and they're rolling these reforms out from the urban areas into the rural areas. We've also seen a new national pension system being developed in India. There's reform happening in Korea. And Japan is a little bit different because it's had a more developed economy. The financial sector has a stronger historical base. But in Japan, we've got an ageing population. We've got a very significant government debt. And the benefits provided at the moment are somewhat lower than would be desirable.
Denmark can boast the world's best scheme according to the Mercer analysis. The Netherlands and Australia rank second and third. Australia has had a public pension scheme for many decades, but Professor Deborah Ralston, director of the Australian Centre for Financial Studies, says given the relatively short time its compulsory superannuation scheme has been operating, the overall ranking is very good.
The Australian superannuation system won't mature until about 2035, so we are still very much an infant system.
Where can the Australian schemes be improved?
One of the things that's very evident is that we tend still to have a culture of a lump sum superannuation payout, but clearly there's a need for some ongoing regular payment on retirement. So we make sure that people's superannuation savings last for a longer period of their retirement and that there's less reliance to come back and rely on the pension.
There's still a lot to do as the social and financial changes, marking the shift to urbanisation and industrialisation, are worked through. Deborah Ralston says one of the areas for improvement is regulation.
One of the reasons why Asian countries may not score so well in that regard is that the relationship between government and business is a lot closer than it tends to be in Anglo-Saxon countries. And there's not such a strong culture of disclosure and accountability in that regard.
And with that report from Karen Snowden, we've come to the end of this edition of Focus Asia Pacific. If you wish to listen to this program again, as well as tune into all past editions, we invite you to check out our website, www.pcjmedia.com/FAP. Once again, www.pcjmedia.com/FAP. We'd also like to find out what you think of the program. You can contact us anytime at the following email address, focus@pcjmedia.com. That's focus@pcjmedia.com. And by the way, while you're at our website, I invite you to check out the phone number for our answer line, and you can leave your recorded comments as well. A special thank you this week goes to Radio Australia for the coverage that we did on the commemoration memorial that was held in Bali for the 10th anniversary of the Bali bombings, as well as to Radio Australia's Karen Snowden and Kandahar Sapati. So until next time, friends, this is Keith Powell wishing you well, hoping we'll see you again in 7 days' time. Bye-bye, everyone.
This is PCJ Radio on 88.2 FM. This is PCJ Radio on 107.5 FM in Nairobi, Kenya. And nationwide on 5. This is PCJ Radio on KBCT in Waco, Texas. This is PCJ Radio on 99.55 kHz to Latin America. This is PCJ Radio on 7590 kHz DRM. On shortwave, satellite, and the internet. This is PCJ Radio.